From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Since the birth of the Solidarity Movement, Lawrence Weschler has been writing about Poland for The New Yorker. On today's Fresh Air, he tells us about his recent trip to Poland, where he watched the difficult transition from communism to democracy. With the holidays coming up, there's probably some champagne in your future. We'll get some advice on moderate and budget-priced sparkling wine. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Havana, starring Robert Redford and Lena Olin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. America's ambassador to Kuwait, Nathaniel Howell, returned to the U.S. today. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from Andrews Air Force Base.
Howell stepped off the C-5A transport and into the chilly air at Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington this afternoon, saying it was great to be home. Howell and his compatriots spent 132 days at the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait that was sealed off by Iraqi soldiers. Today he was met by family and friends bearing bright welcome home balloons and red roses. Secretary of State James Baker was also on hand. He told Howell and the 47 others who arrived with him from Frankfurt that while your ordeal has ended, that of the Kuwaiti people continues. While you have been freed, he said, it is time to free Kuwait. In response, Howell said President Bush's Persian Gulf policy was moral and honorable and right. Then he was embraced by family and friends. This is Brian Naylor at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland.
Defense officials said today that the Pentagon is preparing to handle potential casualties if the country goes to war against Iraq. The Defense Department is deploying more doctors, field hospitals, and blood supplies to the Persian Gulf. Navy officials said that as many as 8,000 more reservists will be called up to support the expansion of medical care for U.S. and allied troops. About 2,300 Navy Reserve medical specialists are being mobilized this week. They'll set up and operate two more 500-bed fleet hospitals in Saudi Arabia. Officials say that one such hospital is already in operation. An extremist Muslim group claimed responsibility today for the stabbing deaths of three Jews on the outskirts of Tel Aviv. The murders have angered Israelis and threatened to spawn another series of revenge attacks against Arabs in Israel. Patricia Golan reports.
The stabbings took place in the industrial zone of the seaside town of Jaffa, just south of Tel Aviv. Two of the victims were attacked in an aluminum factory. Then when a worker at a nearby factory heard the screams and came to investigate, he was himself stabbed to death. The Arabic graffiti scrawled on the walls of the factory were signed by Hamas, the outlawed Islamic resistance movement, which took responsibility for the killings. Security sources say the murders might be linked to the third anniversary of the founding of Hamas, an extremist fundamentalist group whose stronghold is in the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip. Hamas earlier this week called on Palestinians to intensify the intifada through attacks on Jews. As word of the killings spread, a huge crowd gathered outside the factory shouting death to the Arabs. Political activists were not long in coming, further inflaming the crowd. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
Stock prices fell today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 20 points to close at 2,593.8. Declining issues led advances by 2-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, Lech Wałęsa, the former head of Solidarity, became the first popularly elected president of Poland since the Second World War. But Poland's spirit of solidarity has been replaced by infighting between the leaders of the peaceful revolution. My guest Lawrence Weschler has been writing about Poland for The New Yorker since the birth of the Solidarity movement. His most recent trip to Poland was in October. He went to observe the presidential campaign and the political and social transitions from communism to democracy.
I was astonished at the virulence of the infighting. I mean, it really was friendships, the movement and so forth had broken apart, but in ways, people were, there were transferences all over the place. It had kind of the intensity of Last Tango in Warsaw almost. I mean, it was particularly, for example, and one doesn't want to personalize it too much, but the relationship between Lech Wałęsa, as you know, the electrician who became the leader of Solidarity, And Adam Michnik, who was this extraordinary, remarkable intellectual who was one of the leading theorists of solidarity, they used to be very, very close friends. Walesa is the godfather of Michnik's three-year-old child. Michnik used to write, when Walesa was invited to give homilies to the Virgin Mary on crucial moments, he would have his Jewish friend Michnik write them for him, and they would joke about this. And these very warm friends had broken apart spectacularly and, in fact, were just filled with recrimination and hatred and so forth of each other.
Didn't Walesa get the reputation during this election of just making promises that people wanted to hear, no matter how contradictory those promises were?
Well, that's, by the way, not that different from Walesa all along. I mean, people used to... Walesa, if you go back to my reporting in 1981, I mean, he is somebody who would get up, make a speech. He would make very contradictory... He would kind of articulate the mood of the crowd, which felt very contradictory things. By the way, this country's in a very contradictory situation. It's no wonder. So he would be saying things left and right. He'd be saying one thing and then the opposite, not in different speeches, in the same speech. His past reputation is that at a certain moment, he figures out what it is that needs to be done, what the crowd needs to do, wants done, about 30 seconds before the crowd figures it out, and he says it, and then they're all with him. This is very effective when you're in opposition. It's not at all clear that it can be effective when you're president. I mean, I remember back in 1981, people used to joke. They'd say, God, thank God for the communists. Otherwise, this guy would be our president. He's an extremely charismatic, contradictory character who has never, by the way, been in this position, the position he's now going to find himself in, and which may be very, very difficult. A friend of mine in Poland was saying, the thing you have to understand about Walesa is that there never would have been a solidarity without Walesa, in the same way that there never would have been fascism without Mussolini, but also in the same way that there never would have been a Soviet human rights movement without Sakharov. Sakharov and Mussolini get married. They have a child, the baby, Walesa. And it's a kind of vivid way of describing the situation, but that kind of ademocratic quality in Walesa has always been there. It's only now that he's president, that he, for the first time, he is going to be held accountable for the kinds of things he says.
Walesa just won a runoff election against Tominski, who was a Canadian entrepreneur, head of Canada's Libertarian Party. I mean, he hadn't lived in Poland
for
years.
Starters, you make that sound like that's a party. It's an extreme fringe group.
A few people.
It's 3,000 people in all of Canada. And, this was, in a way... Walesa got stung by his own techniques. Tominski, if Walesa was a magic candidate making magic promises that were contradictory, Tominski didn't even bother with contradiction. He just made whole hog promises out of the sky. He was he claimed to be a multimillionaire. He exaggerated his wealth. He was in all sorts of strange ways. He was quite odd at a news conference, a televised news conference. He suddenly said, I know there are people in this room trying to hypnotize me, but it won't work because I know all about hypnosis. He had made a fortune he had made some money in Peru with a cable television station for which the Peruvian government had investigated him for pirating signals and all sorts of odd behavior. I think Poles generally heard this and decided, far out, we'll have great cable television. it was a really mashugana election. And in a way, Walesa didn't know how to deal with this guy because, you know, Mazowiecki, the prime minister in the first round, had been saying we have to behave responsibly, and Walesa had been completely irresponsible in the kinds of promises he was making. Suddenly, after this guy Tominski beat out Mazowiecki, suddenly Walesa had to turn around and say, we have to behave responsibly. And this guy Tominski was making just incredible, strange promises that everybody in Poland would be financially better off within 1 month of his becoming president, and that Poland should have an atomic bomb. I mean, all kinds of wild things.
My guest is journalist Lawrence Weschler, and he's been covering Eastern Europe for the past decade. He's made many trips to Poland and has written about it extensively for The New Yorker magazine. His latest article about Poland was in the December 10th issue of The New Yorker. Weschler was in Poland in October. There's a split in Solidarity now. What is the split about? I should ask you first, what is Solidarity now? Is it a political party? Is it a labor union?
It's dead. It's okay. How's that? I mean, there was this movement that, among other things, was a uniting of intelligentsia and workers. The notion was that the way to oppose communist rule was for the entire society to unite against repression and, in effect, develop an alternative society. And Solidarity did that spectacularly well. I think it's good, in principle, that in a democracy you don't have 10 million solidists. Solidarity used to describe itself. I mean, what you want in democracy is people expressing different interests and so forth. Unfortunately, in the current situation in Poland, things up till this point anyway have fractured in ways in which it's largely personality conflicts that become exacerbated by definite kind of feelings of disquiet and anxiety on the economic front, for example, but they don't yet get articulated in a way that you can make sensible choices between different economic alternatives. In the end, both Wałęsa and Mazowiecki were espousing basically the same system, a system which millions of Poles don't feel they have a stake in. Many of them voted for Tymiński, but Tymiński wasn't espousing any alternative. I guess if you're cynical, you can say that they've basically arrived in one short year at the kind of thing it took us 200 years to arrive at in the United States. I mean, the Democrats and the Republicans don't offer people real solid alternatives between different well-articulated economic viewpoints, for example.
When you say Solidarity is dead, do you mean literally or figuratively?
Well, I mean, there's the union. The union, which had in 1980-81 had 10 million members, never got much more than 2 million after it was re-legalized. The political party or the political movement of Solidarity, which was the movement that swept into power a year ago, has fractured disastrously and is over. But again, that's not the end of the world. That's the precondition for democracy. But by itself, it's not going to make democracy. And Poland is having a hard time developing a democratic system.
Solidarity had bridged intellectuals and workers. It had brought them together. Now that there's a democracy in place, is there still a connection between the intellectuals and the workers, or have they split up?
There were intellectuals who favored Wałęsa. There were workers who favored Mazowiecki in this last election. It's not a completely simple split. I think you could say that, generally speaking, the intelligentsia, which is to say people with linguistic aptitude, people with foreign contacts and so forth, are going to have an easier time as they go into a capitalist system. They are better equipped to deal effectively with the new environment. The people who are really being left by the wayside are the people at those factories, the dinosaur establishments, which tragically are the people who brought this whole thing about in the first place. I mean, it's no different than any other country in the world, except for the fact that it's the very people who brought about the change. Those people in the Gdansk shipyard, the people in the Nowa Huta steelworks, the people in the mines and so forth, who were the ones who made this happen, who for the most part are being left behind.
They're being left behind because they're not in the class that's becoming the entrepreneurs and bringing in new goods to be marketed.
I mean, one way of thinking about it is that they're not the kind of people who can borrow $1,000 from a friend to start a small company.
Mm-hmm.
They're not the people who can, if they want to start. One of the things that's supposed to happen is supposed to be all kinds of upsurge of service industries, laundries, travel agencies, whatever it is. But you need a little money to get started on that, and beyond that, in many of these communities like Nowa Huta, which are entirely devoted to one, now decrepit and about to be closed factory, there's nobody who can afford to pay for laundry services or traveling anywhere and so forth. So it's not working the way it should yet.
With the rise of a new entrepreneurial class in Poland, are you beginning to see a new class structure and more obvious differences between rich and poor?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the nomenklatura, the communist privileged classes in the earlier period, were at least discreet about their privilege. I mean, they didn't flaunt it. The new people driving around in their Mercedes, you can make money extremely quickly if you have any money right now in Poland. And if you have kind of a talent. And the communists are, it should be said, by the way, that in many cases, the people who do have money or do have contacts were former communists. I mean, that's one of the ironies, that the ones who are going to be the most effective capitalists were these people who had a head start because they were communists in the old system. And in any case, now you're beginning to see people just parading their luxury as a kind of nouveau riche and so forth. And this is just making people really crazy.
Let's take a short break. Okay. And then we'll talk some more. My guest is Lawrence Weschler, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's been writing about Poland for about a decade now, and he's written about it extensively in The New Yorker. His latest article was in earlier this month, and he spent October in Poland. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Talking about Poland with Lawrence Weschler, who was a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I'm sure one of the things that was very different about your trip to Poland this October as compared to previous trips is that there was an abundance of food in the stores and in the markets.
Right.
And there were no lines.
They had basically this shock plan, which was instituted January 1st of this year, stopped hyperinflation, and suddenly, basically from one week to the next, the stores were filled with food, with clothes, with all sorts of items. There was an abundance of stuff. The way they did this was that they basically, I'm being somewhat schematic here, but basically they froze wages and allowed prices to reach their own levels. And what you ended up with in this situation was kind of third world wages and first world prices. Prices for apples or potatoes or anything else suddenly, which had been subsidized, the subsidies were all slashed, and suddenly they cost more or less what they would cost in Germany or France. But meanwhile, Poles were earning $100, $150 a month.
So one of the reasons why there's no lines now is that people can't afford to buy the food that's in the stores.
And it's and psychologically, I think this is quite dramatic, because it used to be that Poles had a sense that they couldn't find anything in the stores, but whenever they saw something in the stores, they would buy it and they could afford to buy it. And now the situation is the exact opposite. They see all sorts of things. They see magnificent things. They see apples and pineapples and wool sweaters and fancy suits and so forth, and they can't afford to buy it, and there's no way they're going to be able to afford to buy it.
This leads to a different kind of resentment.
You know, it leads to, most immediately, it leads to an insane election.
Right. is there a new problem with unemployment in Poland?
It's beginning, and what they slashed the subsidies, or they are in the process of slashing the subsidies to those big factories. It used to be that those factories could lose money, and the government would just pump in however much more money was needed to cover the difference. They are beginning to, and they haven't done it so very quickly yet, but they're going to start doing it much more quickly to slash those subsidies and to let those companies go out of business. In theory, the people will get better work in services or whatever else happens to be around, but. In the short term, certainly, there's no banking system, there's no infrastructure, there's no, you know, for example, you can't get a business started because there are no telephones and so forth, and there's no place for those people to find work in huge numbers in any case. So there is already beginning to be, and it's expected it will get much more dramatic in the immediate future, an increase in unemployment.
One of the big questions facing Poland and other countries in Eastern Europe is when you switch from a communist country to a democratic one, what happens to the factories and so on? What happens to everything that used to be state-owned? Does it become privately owned? And if so, who are the people who own it privately? And what happens to the workers? Yeah. What are some of the responses to that being considered now in Poland?
Well, it's an interesting problem. I mean, everybody here just says, oh, well, you just have to privatize and then everything will be fine. That's all very easy. But how do you do it specifically? For example, you can do what's called British-style auctions, where you just suddenly announce that you're going to offer this factory up for sale. But before you can do that, you have to evaluate it. You have to have accountants come in and let people know how much it's worth or what's in it and so forth. And even that's difficult. You have buildings that are owned by one ministry that have factories inside that are answerable to a second ministry, that use equipment that is answerable to a third ministry. Who owns what is not at all clear. It's terribly complicated. So some people are saying, well, maybe on second thought, we shouldn't try and sell the companies, but we can kind of give them away. And what we're basically trying to do is to create control rather than ownership. That's the thing. We want to have kind of a board of directors that will discipline the company. And so there are various schemes afoot for free distribution of money. If you think about the United States, I mean, here's an example about how things in Poland reflect in the United States. You know, the Ford family no longer owns Ford Motors. It's owned by shareholders and by and large by institutional shareholders. It's owned by insurance companies and pension plans and mutual funds and so forth. And one theory is you could let Poland slowly develop what took hundreds of years to develop here. Or another idea is just to start from scratch, to create ex nihilo pension funds and insurance companies and mutual funds and banks and so forth, and then just freely distribute the entire assets of the country in different percentages to these places in the hope that they will then elect boards of directors who will put some discipline on the economy. But even this has terrible complications, and it's not at all obvious how to do it. The most fascinating statistic to me is that has to do with the fact there isn't enough capital in Poland to buy Poland. The book value of the country, of the companies, of the different steel mills and so forth, is such that if you took all of the liquidity in Poland and tried to buy it, you'd only be able to buy 3.2% of the companies. And who would buy the rest? Germans and so forth. And Poles get terrified. I mean, did they go through all this to end up being, you know, have Germans owning their companies and so forth, especially after the war? It's complicated and by no means obvious, and it's a bit disconcerting to see the blitheness with which American government officials and so forth tell the Poles or tell Gorbachev or tell anybody else, just go ahead and privatize your country.
Are people in Poland trained for capitalism? I mean, in the sense that people operated without the kinds of incentives that capitalism is based on, and without the kind of authority that you have when you own something or when you're a manager.
Right. I mean, I think that there are, for one thing, it's a very educated workforce. They are extraordinarily competent. Technically, you have some spectacular computer programmers and computer designers, that sort of thing. You then have a lot of people who apparently are quite good managers. They may not have been allowed to manage before, but they probably would be pretty good managers. What you have beyond that, however, is the fact that, for example, all those financial institutions that we were talking about, mutual funds and insurance companies and banks and so forth, they don't know – nobody in Poland knows how to do any of that stuff. There was never any need for it in the past. I mean, just how to keep books, you know, accounts payable, all that kind of thing. There was no need for it in the past, and so no wonder nobody knows how to do it. But that's a tremendous problem. And then beyond that, there's what people talk about as a kind of debauched work ethic, where people, where workers, you know, in the old days, the old joke, as you know, is they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. People would spend an awful lot of time playing hooky from their work to go stand in line, for example. And since you had to stand in line to get food, it was understandable. Now people probably still need to play hooky from work so as to get some other job so as to be able to buy the food that you don't have to stand in line for anymore. But at the end of the day, that's a problem. You have extremely low productivity, and it's not something you can just change overnight. You have to raise wages enough so people don't have to leave their jobs early to get other kind of jobs. There's all sorts of things like that. And again, we're talking about a situation where the American economy isn't doing so hot. I mean, in fact, all over the world where capitalism is working, you are having a increasing polarization of wealth, as you're seeing in the United States. You're seeing the middle class being eaten away with more and more people, with some people making it into the upper class and more people making it into falling back into the lower middle class and so forth. And so we don't have any particular solutions to offer Poles in this regard.
Lawrence Wechsler is my guest, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he's been writing about Poland for the past decade. His last trip there was in October, and he most recently wrote about Poland in the December 10th issue of The New Yorker. What effect is the Gulf crisis having in Poland now? Do they have shortages of oil?
It's not so much shortages of oil, but the price of oil has just skyrocketed.
Oh.
And this, by the way, is going to be the second big shock, because what's happening on January 1st of next year, I mean, in a few weeks now, is that all the Soviet prices with trade with the Soviet Union are going to go on a hard currency basis. So whereas before it didn't really matter what the world price of oil was, suddenly Poland is going to have to pay in dollars or marks or some other hard currency for the oil they generally get from the Soviet Union at the world price. It's going to be disastrous. The other thing, by the way, about that's very problematic is that there's this noise when you're in Poland right now. When you're trying to talk to people, have a conversation with people, you almost can't make yourself heard because of this racket. And people literally look to the east where this noise is coming from, and they say, you know, what the hell is going on over there? And that noise is the sound of the Soviet Union falling over the precipice. I mean, it is changing everything in Eastern Europe. The major trading partner of all these countries is falling into anarchy and taking down these countries with it. And, you know, these people, you literally, people cock their heads toward the east saying, I don't know what's going to happen. Look what's going on over there. And then in horror, they look at their own feet and they see the oil pipelines and the gas pipelines and so forth leading out from Warsaw toward the east. And they wonder whether they're going to be dragged down too. And in some places, they are being dragged down.
What leaves you the most optimistic and what leaves you the most concerned about Poland's future?
The most optimistic is for all of the vitriolic acting out that's been expressed in the last few years and the last few months. People like Michnik and Wałęsa and so forth. This is a remarkable group of people, Wałęsa included, by the way. And this is a generation that is the equivalent of the founding fathers of our own country. By the way, it's worth remembering that you know, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams fell out with each other and didn't have a word to say to each other for decades. That, you know, Alexander Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr. I mean, there are all kinds of wild things that happened in the United States right after our victory. But this is a generation that is of that caliber. And there are great people there, and they have behaved extraordinarily more brilliantly than any other national liberation movement during the same period. So that's hopeful. What's difficult is, what is the darkest, I think, is that the world that they are coming into, this kind of the capitalist world, exacts terribly difficult price, has rather serious disfiguring problems of its own. They are entering it hugely idealistically and with wide eyes and in huge innocence and are setting themselves up for some disastrous disappointments, I worry.
Lawrence Wechsler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Now, my guest has been Lawrence Wechsler. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, where his latest article on Poland appeared December 10th. He spent October in Poland. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up just in time for the holidays, some advice about affordable champagne. From Joshua Wesson and David Rosengarten, co-editors of the Food and Wine Companion, and food writer Corby Kummer of The Atlantic magazine. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Havana, starring Robert Redford as a card shark in Cuba who falls in love with a revolutionary on the eve of the revolution. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has set a new deadline for a meeting between Secretary of State Baker and Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
President Bush has been trying to set up a meeting between Baker and Saddam Hussein ever since the UN Security Council approved a resolution authorizing military force in the Persian Gulf. The administration wants a meeting by January 3rd. Saddam Hussein has been holding out for January 12th. But President Bush says January 12th is too late in view of the January 15th deadline the UN set for Iraq to withdraw completely from Kuwait.
I would say that we've given so many alternatives here that he ought to stay with, accept one of these, if he's serious. Now, if it's simply that he's trying to manipulate, that is what I will have no part of.
U.S. officials insist that the sole purpose of a meeting is not to negotiate with Saddam Hussein, but to make a face-to-face demand that Iraq get out of Kuwait. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
With a month to go before a U.N. Security Council deadline for Iraq to get out of Kuwait, defense preparations are underway in the Middle East. Bomb shelters are being built in Iraq, and there is civil defense and first aid training underway, along with plans to evacuate major Iraqi population centers. On the day that the deadline runs out, January 15th, evacuation drills are scheduled in the capital. President Bush says that he plans to nominate outgoing Illinois Congresswoman Lynn Martin as his new Secretary of Labor. Martin, a longtime Bush advisor who co-chaired his winning presidential campaign, would follow Elizabeth Dole, who stepped down to head the American Red Cross. NPR's Paz Cohen has more.
Martin's staff credits her with pushing through a 1988 rule that requires House members to follow the Fair Employment Guidelines of the Civil Rights Act. That same year, Martin's voting record got its highest score ever from the AFL-CIO, 46 out of a possible 100. In light of Martin's record, AFL-CIO spokesman James Parks says organized labor could be happier with the choice of labor secretary.
During her period of service, her voting record has not reflected a sensitivity to the needs of workers.
Martin was widely rumored to be in line for the labor post because she's a Bush loyalist and a woman, and as a reward for giving up the House seat she held for 10 years to challenge Democratic Senator Paul Simon. Martin lost the election by nearly a million votes. I'm Paz Cohen in Washington.
And the nation's factories cut production last month at the steepest rate in nearly 9 years. According to the government, the drop-off in production covered a wide range of goods from clothing to building material. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 20 points to close at 2,593.81. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. With Christmas and New Year's coming up, chances are there's some champagne in your future. And it might be your turn to buy it. So we've invited two experts to talk with us about taste and cost. Joshua Wesson and David Rosengarten edit the newsletter The Wine and Food Companion, and they co-wrote the book Red Wine with Fish, The New Art of Matching Food with Wine.
Do you mind if we open a bottle here?
Yeah.
Pretty good. Just kidding.
What's the difference between champagne and sparkling wine?
$10. Just kidding. Champagne gets its name from the region that it is produced in. Champagne is a place in France. It's also the name of the most famous wine that comes from that region. And any sparkling wine that is made in a champagne style outside of the region of Champagne has to be called sparkling wine. It can't be called champagne.
The French don't want them to call it that?
Right, it's their trademark. Right.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is what Josh says is true for France and is true for all the common market countries. Of course, there are other countries in the world who say we can call it whatever the heck we want to call
it. Like America.
Like America. And California sparkling wine is sometimes called champagne and sometimes not.
And I've had cold duck champagne, which is
yes,
fine stuff.
So how do they get the bubbles in it?
Well, there are three ways you can put bubbles in champagne. Well, three ways you can put bubbles into wine. You can make it like Coca-Cola and just inject carbon dioxide in, and that's the way that that lovely champagne cold duck is fizzed. Or you can induce a process of fermentation in a bottle. You've probably seen the words naturally fermented in the bottle in a number of sparkling wine labels. And you actually turn a bottle into a little factory. You add yeast and sugar, and when yeast and sugar get together, they end up producing carbon dioxide and alcohol. If you keep a lid on things, then you have the carbon dioxide stuck in there, and that's the way that really good sparkling wines get their bubbles.
There's a third way as well, as Josh mentioned. It's called the Charmat method, and then they create this the second fermentation in a big tank, and then they put it in bottles later.
So besides the fermentation process, are there other differences between the cheaper and more expensive champagnes, or shall I say the more inexpensive and the more expensive champagnes?
Well, one thing that you you pay a lot of money for is the luxury of having someone else age your wine for you. And a lot of champagne is aged for a fairly long period of time, and the longer that you keep a wine out of the buyer's hands, the more you have to pay the person who's selling the wine to you.
And also in answer to your question, another big difference is grape varieties. Mm-hmm. When champagne is made, real champagne, made in Champagne, France, it's made from three grape varieties, sometimes only one, sometimes two, but three go into it, Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and another grape less well-known called Pinot Meunier. These grapes are high-class grapes, and they make very, very complex and very elegant wine.
What do you think of the inexpensive sparkling Spanish wines like Freixenet?
Well, I think that David and I don't believe in wines being good or bad because they are inexpensive or expensive. We think of wines in their place on a table next to food. And champagnes tend to go well with certain kinds of foods. And sparkly wines like Freixenet, sparkly wines from California, sparkling wines from areas outside of Champagne tend to go with other kinds of food. David and I love to serve champagne with very elegant and refined food that doesn't overwhelm the elegance and complexity of the champagne. But if we are sitting around and having some food that's a bit spicy, we would never serve champagne with it. We would always reach for a bottle of a Spanish sparkling wine because all of that complexity would get lost in the spice, and we like the roughness. In fact, the coarseness of a Spanish sparkling wine can be a benefit.
When you're buying champagne and the label says brut or extra dry, what does it mean?
Oh, man, that terminology is so confusing.
Only the French could come up with terminology that would leave people so fabulously confused that extra dry would actually mean something that's sweeter than brut. And, in fact, that is the case. These words are designations of levels of sweetness in the sparkling wine or champagne. And what happens is if you are a champagne or a sparkling wine producer, you will decide right before you ship the wine out to the different places that it will go to how much sugar to add to the wine. You add it in the form of sugar that's been dissolved into a little bit of still wine, and then you dose the bottle, you put the cork on, and then you send it out. If you want to make a very, very dry sparkling wine or champagne, then you add very little sugar and you call it brut. If you want to make it a bit sweeter, then you add a little bit more sugar and you label it extra dry. And in fact, there are even sweeter champagnes than extra dry. There are champagnes that taste very much like dessert wines, and they are labeled demi-sec or even sweeter than demi-sec,
Yes, and wish to point out that very often people open a bottle of champagne with dessert because it's a good point in the meal for the toast, and then they open a bottle of something that's labeled brut, and it costs $30, and they're wasting their wine because with the dessert, the wine is going to get clobbered. You're not going to be able to taste it. It's going to taste like lemon juice with bubbles. So it's always a good idea to serve a sweeter champagne with dessert if you're toasting.
One of the things that drives us crazy is when we go to weddings and we see people wheel out huge wedding cakes, and then they serve a dry sparkling wine or a brut champagne. David and I both keep a little bit of Domino sugar in our wallets. we call it Cristal Helper.
I can imagine what the hosts are thinking as you slip it in.
We're discreet.
Yeah. You guys write a lot about what kinds of wines go with what kinds of foods.
Yes.
What goes good with champagne?
More champagne.
Yeah,
more
really?
Champagne. Yes. Actually, we believe it or not, we've got a good answer to that question. We've got a few groups of foods that we like to serve with champagne. First of all, you notice that when you go to a meal in a fancy restaurant, very often you're served a little what they call amuse-bouche, something to amuse your mouth first before the serious food starts coming out. And very often a glass of champagne is offered with that. Furthermore, very often that amuse-bouche is something that's deep-fried. And I can't quite figure out why exactly, so don't ask me, but deep-fried foods and champagne go very, very well together. It's almost as if the bubbles sort of scrape any residual oil off the palate that comes from the deep-frying.
I've got a little bit of an idea of why that works. Champagnes and sparkling wines tend to be made from grapes that are fairly acidic, and when you have acidic grapes, you end up making acidic wine. And champagnes, being so acidic, tend to act like a McCullough chainsaw and cut right through all the grease of deep-fried items. It's a really nice contrast.
And so you can use it in that way as an aperitif, but Josh and I always champion high-low food matches and food and wine matches, and I think a great bottle of champagne and a picnic of southern fried chicken would be just fantastic.
I would go farther and say chicken McNuggets.
Chicken McNuggets, yeah.
Because champagne is comparatively expensive, I think a lot of people assume you should eat it with expensive food like champagne and caviar, but you don't think
right.
champagne and caviar go together very well.
Oh, that's our deep, dark secret.
Ball bearings filled with fish oil and salt.
Yes,
we're
going to
blow the lid on this caviar thing.
Caviar wishes, champagne nightmares.
David and I have, Petrosian has put a price on our heads for saying this, but in fact, we find that if you have a champagne that is slightly sweet, and a lot of champagnes have a little bit of sugar added to them, whether they're extra dry or even if they're labeled Brut, that little bit of sugar will bring out the fishiness in caviar, and that's the one thing that you don't want to do when you're eating a spoonful of caviar.
Joshua Wesson and David Rosengarten are my guests. They published the newsletter The Wine and Food Companion, and they co-wrote the book Red Wine with Fish, The New Art of Matching Food with Wine. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Joshua Wesson and David Rosengarten are my guests. Do you have any recommendations of affordable champagnes?
Yeah, you know, there are a few good ones in the market these days. Not affordable champagnes, I'm afraid, strictly speaking champagne, but affordable sparkling wines.
Yes.
From France, there's a champagne that's in the market right now called Silver Cloud Blanc de Blanc, and it's from an area in France called Blanquette de Limoux. Which is little known in the U.S. It costs about $7, and it's a very good champagne substitute. It doesn't have the complexity, but it's very light and crisp. Also, we were talking about Spain before, and in the northeast corner of Spain, they make a great deal of sparkling wine called Cava. And there's a very good one in the market right now from the big house Codornillo, or Codornio, the 1987 Blanc de Blanc, which sells for about $7, and has a little bit of that good grape in it, a little bit of Chardonnay, which I think helps to give it its class.
Can you recommend a champagne in the, say, $15 a bottle category? $15 to $20, something.
Something significant has happened in the Champagne region recently in France. They had a dispute between the people who grow grapes and the people who make wine out of them. And the upshot of this dispute is that champagne prices are going up. So the champagne bargain that you used to be able to find at $15 is soon going to be anywhere from $20 to $25. It's horrible, tragic news for champagne lovers, but these prices are seriously going up after January 1st.
Which reason? So, this is the actual Champagne region?
This is the Champagne region of France, yes.
Wow.
So for people who want to buy champagne, now is really the time to stock up, because really in just a few weeks it's going to be over.
And the best value is to be had. If you really want a champagne, if you don't want to get a sparkling wine from elsewhere, look for non-vintage Brut champagnes. Those are invariably the best values to come out of champagne. and look for wines that come from smaller houses. The smaller the house, the less well-known, the less demand there is for the wine usually, and the better the price. And right now is the best time to go and look for champagnes because most retailers are heavily discounting sparkling wine and champagne for the holidays.
Two houses in Champagne, France that we particularly like are Charles Heidsieck and Joseph Perrier, spelled just like this, just like the stuff in the green bottles.
If you drink a lot of champagne, are you going to get more hungover than drinking other alcoholic beverages because of the sugar?
The sugar is not so much a factor in making you feel like you've had too much to drink, but it's really the bubbles that are driving the alcohol into the bloodstream more quickly. You absorb more alcohol more quickly when you're drinking a sparkling wine than when you're drinking a still wine. And it doesn't have anything to do with the sugar or the actual level of alcohol. It has to do with the way that it's being really literally pushed in to the bloodstream, being absorbed by the stomach.
And I must say, it's been my experience that maybe things do happen a little more quickly and a little more giddily with champagne. But the next day, I find myself in very good shape. If you have an all-champagne dinner, I think you'll have less of a hangover than with other things.
Even though it's getting to your bloodstream quicker?
Yeah. I'm not a doctor, so I really don't know why. But certainly, this is the legend about champagne. And certainly when you go to the Champagne region, this is what everyone tells you consistently, that you'll feel much better the next day. And it's been my experience that in this case, the PR people are right.
One last question. Will you be drinking champagne during the holidays, on New Year's Eve perhaps?
I'll be drinking champagne at David's house.
Oh, my She's champagne again, Josh? Yes. I do like to drink champagne at holiday time, but that's nothing unusual. I like to drink champagne year-round whenever I can afford it.
Right. Okay.
Well. I may be drinking the champagne of bottled beer. Yes. That's all I can afford.
Well, I want to thank you both a lot for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Joshua Wesson and David Rosengarten co-edit the newsletter The Wine and Food Companion. There's an article about inexpensive Spanish sparkling wine, or cava, in this month's Atlantic magazine. We called the writer, Corby Kummer, and he told us about a taste test that he tried on some friends.
Well, I brought to a nice restaurant a bottle of very fancy, but not $100, $40 bottle of champagne, which is kind of the fashionable champagne among food professionals right now. You see it when chefs get together after a long night and they want to treat themselves to something. And I brought at the same time a $6 bottle of Freixenet Cordon Negro, the kind that comes in the black bottle. And we did a blind taste test. It wasn't rigorous, and it wasn't among food professionals. There were a couple people who lived in France for 2 years and knew their wines, but never bring a bottle of wine out from their cellar and tell you about it for 15 minutes before you get to eat the main course. They just like wine. And everybody preferred the cheap champagne. They thought it was clean and fresh and, I guess, undemanding, which might not be the very best thing to say for a wine, but in this case it seemed absolutely appropriate.
Why did you do this? What were you trying to prove?
Well, I guess I was trying to prove that you don't have that Spanish wine is made really carefully and really well, and so is Californian, and can compare quite well to a fancy $40 a bottle, or $20 to be franker about what a lot of champagnes cost. And you don't have to be ashamed of it. But I wasn't even that interested in holding it up against other French wines so that it could play with the big boys. I was just trying to prove what's good to drink, because champagne isn't drunk the way other wines are. You don't usually sit down and all conversation stops while you carefully test the champagne to see how it is. And then everybody nods at each other, waits for the most senior person to say what he thinks. It's usually in the context of a party. It's drunk with a lot of other things, and people don't pay all that much attention to it. They want it to be refreshing, good, stimulating, and festive. And cava, Spanish wine, is that very much. So are a lot of California ones. And you don't necessarily need the most expensive champagne to get all the virtues of champagne.
Okay, if you think this $6 a bottle stuff tastes pretty good, how do they make it that cheaply?
Well, they make it in huge quantities because the Spanish wine industry was really casting about for something to make after a terrible blight that wiped out almost all of European wines, phylloxera, in the 1870s to 90s. And they thought, well, we have to recover. What can we do that will make a lot of money? We'll copy France and Champagne because we can grow grapes kind of like that. And we'll use the same methods they do, but on a huge scale. And we've got a lot more land because we don't have to worry about this carefully, precisely defined region. We can grow them wherever they'll grow well. So they went into it just thinking of it as an industrialized product. And it's important to remember that that's what most champagne is. It just started in, really, most of Europe began drinking it in the 19th century in any real quantity, and in this century, too.
Well, you know, I was just speaking with the editors of a Food and Wine newsletter who suggested that if you want to drink an inexpensive Spanish cava, that the food to eat it with would be a spicy food, like Mexican food, for instance. What do you think of that?
I think that's good advice, and I kind of believe everything they say. I think they're terrific. I also think that people don't pay a lot of attention to what food they're having with champagne. They're toasting something. They're getting the evening off to a great start. It's going to be festive. One of the main reasons I wrote the article was because all of my friends, if they are bringing champagne to a party, will go out and buy a $7 or $10 bottle of champagne and hang their heads and sort of hide it. And once it's unwrapped or it comes out of the ribbon, they'll put it behind the French champagne or the stuff with a label that looks fancy and doesn't look Spanish. There's not a reason in the world to be ashamed of it. It's a perfectly fine and refreshing, and who knows what hors d'oeuvres are going to be served? Who knows what food is going to go with it? I think people don't usually pay attention to it. They just want something that will be brisk and get the evening off to a great start.
Well, Corby, I wish you happy holidays.
And you too.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Corby Kummer is a senior editor at The Atlantic Magazine, where he also writes about food.
I get no kick from champagne. Mere alcohol, it doesn't move me at all. So tell me, why should it be true that I get a kick out of you? Some like the bop type refrain. I'm sure that if I heard even one riff, 'twould bore me terrifically too. Yet I get a kick out of you.
This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll be talking with two ministers and a rabbi about the question, what is worth dying for? Talking with them about their own experiences and the advice they're giving to their congregations as the Persian Gulf conflict continues. The Department of Education has recommended that colleges that have scholarships based on race be denied federal funding, and we'll talk with two admissions officers. There's been a massive outpouring of food and medicine, other supplies to the Soviet Union. Soviet watcher Marshall Goldman explains some of the reasons and warns some of the food could fall into the wrong hands. And Bob Garfield on bingo.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Sidney Pollack's new movie Havana is about a passionate love affair in a hot country on the brink of revolution. It stars Robert Redford and Lena Olin. How much heat does the movie really give off? Film critic Stephen Schiff takes its temperature.
With Havana, director Sidney Pollack is trying to make the kind of movie they don't make him like anymore. Star-crossed lovers moaning and heaving against a backdrop of thrilling political turmoil. The movie is essentially Casablanca Goes Merengue, with Lena Olin as the Swedish-born wife of an aristocratic Cuban revolutionary, and Robert Redford as the American gambler who doesn't give a hoot about anything until he meets her. The setting, of course, is Havana during the last weeks of 1958, the last weeks before Batista's government gave way to Castro's government. Unfortunately, the movie's politics are grade school simple. The revolutionaries are good, and the government is bad, and the reason for the revolution is that life in Cuba just isn't fair. The larger issues at stake in this movie aren't political, they're romantic. In fact, they're the same issues Sidney Pollack has always built his blockbusters around. Havana is about commitment versus uncertainty, about the conflict between one lover who is fervent and free of doubt about her beliefs and one who can't imagine being that cocksure about anything. This kind of friction ought to make for a juicy, romantic tug of war, but something is rotten in Havana. Part of the problem, you may have heard, is a lack of chemistry between Redford and Olin. Well, chemistry is hard to define. But could any two acting styles be less compatible? Here's Redford, for instance, telling Olin a story with his usual glamorous sang-froid.
I knew this old hustler when I was a kid. And he showed me how he had this diamond sewed into his arm by a doctor. So when I was in Yokohama, I bought a diamond and I had a Jap doctor do it. See, the idea was that no matter how bad things got, no matter what they did to you, no matter what, you'd still have this last chance. You'd always have this diamond.
Talk about vanilla ice. And here's Olin.
How many times have you lost everything? Lots of times, yes. Maybe it's possible to come back from that. There are so many ways to be happy, and I feel that. With you, I feel that sometimes, but sometimes...
Yipes, hot stuff coming through. Watching these two is like playing with one of those black-and-white optical illusions where you either see a lamp or two faces looking at each other, but not both at once. If you buy Redford, you can't buy Olin, and vice versa. Ah, but if only the movie's troubles ended there. Here's Robert Redford doing some of the most committed acting we've seen from him in years, and I still couldn't see through his cucumber cool to the grubby passion and despair that his character is supposed to be feeling. Meanwhile, where's the movie's sense of fun? Havana during the final days ought to have a little razzmatazz. It ought to be spicy and naughty and funny, but the movie is so solemn it just sits there like a lox. It looks great. The Cuban sets are stunningly beautiful, and Pollack has shot them in a splashy, chaotic style, full of pointillist splotches of intense color. And yet, even during the big riot scene, after Batista's government falls, we're stuck watching lots of extras tripping gingerly down the stairs, and then trotting delicately through the streets, not running, not hurtling, trotting. It all seems to be happening very, very far away.
Stephen Schiff is critic-at-large for Vanity Fair. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Joan Tui. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Richard Rhodes looks back on his childhood when he was beaten and starved by his stepmother. He's written a memoir about being an abused child called A Hole in the World. Also, John Updike on the last of his Rabbit novels. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.